If you don't know Rover, they're such a dominant player in the pet services place, whether it's dog walking, mostly dog sitting or places, instead of pawning off your animal on your neighbors or your family, you can get these guys to help. I'm going to let him give a better intro, but exciting news. If you read the Wall Street Journal, there's a proposed transaction from led by Blackstone on the private equity side for to take you guys private for about $2.3 billion. Well, fingers crossed. I hope you guys get what you want there. Aaron, thanks for making time to be on the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
So correct my bad elevator pitch there. Tell people what Rover really is.
You did a great job. I mean, Rover is an alternative to traditional boarding facilities and begging your friends, family, and neighbors when you're away from your home and you need pet care. We offer six services, but the two primary use cases are what to do with your dog when you leave on vacation and what to do with your dog when you go into work. And over the last several years, we've had a big explosion in the amount of cats on Rover as well. We have some other animal types as well. So it's beyond dogs now too.
Oh, great. So I guess the first question for me is, I mean, obviously we had the COVID puppies, and I have a lot of friends who their family got an animal too. But in general, pet ownership has grown faster than the population growth. What do you attribute that to?
We have a very long-term view of this. Ultimately, we think it's a function of per capita income and education levels. When you look across countries, as per capita income rises, you have typically higher education levels reached by the population in general. What that means is people tend to get married later in life or not at all, and they tend to have fewer human children or none at all. And so you have a dynamic where people have more disposable income, but fewer human children. And that kind of creates this vacuum where we have our needs for affection, love, and attention and devotion, start to happen more with the animals in our lives. And we call that as going from pet as property to pet as family member to pet as child. And it's pretty universally globally.
You know, I'm just chuckling over here because I grew up in a farm town for my teenage years, and we do not like put coats on dogs and stuff. Okay, but even though it's cold Canada, but my mother-in-law, like her dogs are for sure like equal status or like higher status than some of her human children, and she for sure thinks about herself as a pet parent, and like my wife too. I got her this mini Labradoodle that just is like follows around like her shadow. And like, yeah, she definitely considers herself a doggy mom. So
I'm very much a pet parent.
Emotional spending correlates.
Yeah, and it's amazing. The share wallet continues to grow. So it's not only that pet ownership grows faster than the population in general. The actual share of wallet per pet grows as well. So our industry has several kind of multi-decade tailwinds attached to it. That kind of almost creates a dynamic where the industry is recession-proof. I don't want to say that that's always true, but during the Great Recession, pretty much every industry went backwards. The pet industry was one of the industries that grew throughout without any hitches.
Yeah. So I'm interested in your thoughts about growing a billion-dollar-plus business. When you think about a billion-dollar success secret, you know, there's so many people that would like to accomplish that. And statistically, it's so wildly uncommon. What's one of the principles that's been really meaningful to you?
I think, well, first and foremost, it's always building for the long term. You know, it's there are people in the business world that seem to be able to predict trends, jump on the bandwagon and sell companies at the exact right moment. We've never thought that there's any reason to think that we'll be that lucky. And so we've always just wanted to build a great, independent, long-term oriented company. And if you're too concerned about next month, next fundraise, short-term valuation dynamics, you lose sight of the things that really matter over time.
Yeah. How do you help spread that across the team and make sure like the water gets to the end of the row on that mentality?
I think it starts with culture and values. When you're in early startup days, you have a limited number of months before you're out of business. It can be very easy to be incredibly short-term focused. You're understaffed, so like everyone's kind of doing everything and you wonder whether or not anyone's doing it well. But we decide very early on to kind of cement our company values in stone. And we thought that that would be very important for both scaling the organization and attracting and retaining the types of people that we wanted to be at the company. We didn't have any delusion. I don't think that any reasonable person, straight out of college or, maybe with a decade of experience in tech is like, okay, this business is clearly going to be the next Google overnight. Yes. we were going to have a value proposition to our employees that was not, hey, this is a get rich quick opportunity that, and we thought that having a culture and environment that people actually loved and bringing in people that they actually wanted to work with was going to serve us well over time.
Yeah. For so many people, I mean, it'd be hard to find a CEO today who doesn't talk about culture, right? But for some of them, it's just posters on the wall and what they talk about at the executive meeting. But if you go talk to the staff, a few layers down the org chart, they're like, oh yeah, I think I saw that poster once. I don't know, I just do my job, right?
Totally.
When you think about this idea of culture being real, like not just something that gets talked about at the meetings, it's not just the posters on the wall, it's not just at the rah-rah events, it's like actually how we operate day to day. What's advice you have for other of us CEOs and people trying to do that in our organizations?
If you can't name daily something that happened or some interaction or communication that probably would have been different if you didn't have the values you had, then your values probably aren't real. And one of the things that's always so heartwarming to me is when non-executives bring up cultures and values and can point to specific opportunities or even call other people out in a polite way. You know, one of our values is discipline in how you debate. And that means there's a little bit of an explanation on it, but at a high level, we want to argue in a high integrity and robust way, and we want to get to solutions. So at Rover, in that value, it's frowned upon to disagree with something without offering a counterproposal. Because it's very easy to be negative. It's very easy to say, I don't like that. I think that's dumb. It's harder to be like, here's how I think that could be improved, or here's what I would do instead. And you will actually have people in meetings say, okay, I think this is the wrong path. I don't have yet a counterproposal, but I'm working on it. Give me a minute. And like, you will see it real time and how people interact with each other, or you'll see people just propose, okay, I hear the feedback, what's your counterproposal? And so it's real in a way that doesn't exist at a lot of companies. And when you see day-to-day behavioral changes due to the values, you know it's not just things on a wall. And we also get little telltale signs from employees that have either left the company at some point or have come from other environments, and they're like, oh, wow, you guys talked a lot about the values and culture. It's part of the interview process, but it's real. I've never seen it this way. I've never had people up and down the organization embrace it in this manner. You never wish bad environments on anyone, but it does feel good when people say, wow, this feels very different than what I'm used to.
Yeah. Give us some examples of what that looks like inside Rover.
Yeah, and in addition to the how we debate, we have a no office politics value, and it's kind of like, really, no, like we actually mean that. And so we want people to have career ambitions, We think that that's healthy and good, and everyone has life goals. But it is very much frowned upon and contrary to our values to propose things because of personal career interests. And so you will see people actually lay that on the table and set it aside and say, hey, I actually think this may be easier for my job if we do X, Y, and Z, but I'm going to ignore that. Now let's talk about the issue at stake. And if you just don't see a lot of shameless self-interest being proposed at Rover, and if so, like those people typically don't last long. Then there's, you know, very polite, thoughtful conversations that happen with those individuals. But you just don't see it. And so you will actually see people in the case where they like, oh, I have a really tough time setting aside my personal interest here because of X, Y, and Z. I just want to let you know, I really would like this job. but now let me talk to you about why I think I might be the right candidate for it. And so you'll see those types of interactions, regularly at Rover. Our devotion to our community is another big value. We have people that live our mission, and our mission is to make it possible for everyone to experience the unconditional love of a pet. And you'll see it with the incredible amount of empathy and investments we've done in things like trust and safety. For everyone at Rover, like these are, you know, these mostly four-legged creatures, sometimes two-legged, sometimes three-legged. But like, you know, we have such amazing respect and appreciation for the unique role they have in people's lives. And when we make decisions for the business, we're coming from the perspective of customers and that unique human pet bond.
Yeah. You took over in 2011, is that right?
Yes, I was a co-founder and employee number one, but one of our other co-founders we credit with coming up with the idea.
Okay. So, you know, if you're employee number one, was like how many other staff in 2011? Like what was the team total there?
We had a couple contractors, kind of prototyping a beta version. It was originally pitched at a startup weekend event. As an alternative to kennels, a kind of think Airbnb for dogs. There was one person from that startup weekend team that started working on some prototype code. Then we brought on a second contract engineer, and then a couple non-engineering people for the business side.
And how many staff now?
Oh, about 500, give or take.
Does that include Europe, or are you all domestic based? Or
no, we have a decent sized office in Barcelona, and then we have groups of employees in Houston and Spokane as well.
Yeah, when you think about that type of expansion, you know, you start getting into like the tens of employees, and all of a sudden you don't know everybody's names anymore. You start getting to the hundreds of employees, and you're like, I don't know if I've ever seen that person before, right? Talk to me about having these culture and values not get diluted when you're bringing different people with different perspectives in and there's such opportunity for dilution.
Such a good call out. And, you know, like you will fail as a leader to the degree that you rely on the tools to spread the culture and values that worked when you were 20 people, when you're a couple hundred. And we have hundreds of thousands of providers on the platform and, you know, million plus owners, there was this transition that, you know, where it goes from like things like being able to step aside from your self-interest and really come from what makes sense for our customers in the business. You know, there was a period of time where like people really learned that via osmosis just by interacting with me or some of the other leaders. And then you realize there's no osmosis anymore because I may not interact with certain people or certain leaders may not interact with certain people on a regular basis. And so you really have to figure out how to cascade that so that it's primary in your leaders and managers' minds, so that in addition to senior management reinforcement, they're getting it through osmosis on an ongoing way, but not osmosis via me. You know, and that was an interesting transition, because you do have to be more intentional with reinforcement. You do have to be more intentional when landing certain messages. You do have to be a little bit more public around living the values in certain ways. So we have always appreciated people as part of our values that can own mistakes and tell it like it is, particularly about themselves. It's easy to tell how it is about someone else. It's harder to be like, you know, I screwed this up. This was my bad. Like, this could not have been a worse decision. And so, you know, there are times that we realize, you know what, like, it's worth just calling that out company-wide so that they can see us kind of owning it in the same way that we expect others to own it. But that conversation would have happened in a side conversation, you know, in the first couple of years of the company. And then at a certain point, like, no, like, it's useful for everyone to hear this. Like, here's what we got right. Here's what we got wrong. Similarly, you know, we weirdly, in the tech industry, there's sometimes this weird dysfunctional narrative that because leaders in the tech industry are supposed to be visionaries, you have to be able to have perfect visibility into the future. And I don't know where that came from, as if like every entrepreneur or leader of the tech industry somehow can predict the future perfectly. But like there is this pretense that a lot of tech CEOs have about knowing what's the future is going to be like on pretty much every dimension. And we kind of shun that perspective, or, you know, so we try and actually communicate the level of conviction we have about something as part of the communication, you know, and if we have high conviction, we say it with a lot of confidence. And if we have medium conviction, we say it with medium conviction. And if we have low conviction, we say something along the lines of, you know, my lean is this, you know, I think it's probably going to go this way, but it could go this way. And so communicating that level of certainty and also being mindful to do it at different times in very public forums, company-wide meetings, is a great way of reinforcing the, hey, there's no need to pretend like you know everything, because no one does. But it, you know, required us to be a little bit more intentional past a certain point.
How often are you having a big company-wide meeting?
Well, we have, post being a public company, we went to quarterly and after our earnings release, because we, for employees that may want to sell their shares, we didn't want to be constantly feeding them insider information that would get them in trouble with the SEC. But we then, every several weeks, we have company-wide optional meetings where there can be certain topics. We have periodic meetings where we'll go really deep on a single company value, give examples, how we live it, like where it goes wrong, why it's hard. And those, you know, there's probably 3 to 5 of those a quarter in addition to the kind of company-wide financial review post-earnings.
With such a spread out world these days, how do you decide what's in person, what's on Zoom, these kind of things?
Oh, that's hard. I think we're still working through it in a lot of ways. I think one of the things about going into Europe when we did was our main base of employees in Europe was in Barcelona, and we were on the west coast of the U.S., and so that forced us to think hard early on about how do you make sure those employees, based on the distributed nature of their location, don't feel like second-class citizens. So we actually, the executives changed their calendar, and a bunch of other people did too, specifically to be available early certain days and block out time specifically for interactions with our European office so that the employees there would have a fairly high expectation of being able to interact directly with people while it still made sense in their time zone. So we were intentional not to say, okay, well, you know, because headquarters is in Seattle, you know, you will stay up crazy late or get up crazy early, and said, okay, like, how can we meet in the middle here so that we're on equal footing? But it's hard. And, you know, the challenges of a remote team in Barcelona, but that actually has an office is different than remote workers that may be in any number of states. And how do you make sure that they feel connected? How do you make sure that the iteration and the feedback loop, both positive praise and constructive opportunities, doesn't suffer due to the distance? Where do you need to be intentional about checking in on people? One of the hardest adjustments to a remote offices or some amount of remote working, I think, was, hate using this term again, but like there's a certain amount of information that comes about what's going on in people's life that's relevant as a manager that just happened through osmosis when you're in the office. Wow, someone's looking sad today. Like someone is distracted quite a bit. Like, and you just get these signals to be like, hey, are you okay? Is there something going on? Like, how can I support you? But you don't get those signals unless you actually have a Zoom scheduled with someone. And so you have to be a lot more intentional about those check-in periods. That's true, especially with remote work, but it's also true with satellite offices. And that's just one of the things that breaks down, that there was an unintentional but pretty good solution for prior to more distributed work.
Yeah. Well, I want to switch gears. We've talked about inside the company. Let's talk about outside the company. So you breezed over real quick, having over a million customers today. For other people who are looking at trying to market at that kind of a level, what's a piece of advice you have?
My biggest piece of advice is vision is great, but what you really where you really actually get your accomplishments is through strategy, not vision. And what I mean by that is a lot of people will conflate vision and strategy. And, you know, for us, vision is kind of really an end state. Strategy is path. It's the how. How do you get there? And so what we think about a lot is what path is going to get you there? Like what first, what second, what third, what fourth? And when you get to fourth, what's broken about one and two that you need to go back and reexamine? You know, it may be almost trite, but if you want to go far distance, you have to, you know, start with the first step. And so for us is like, okay, what can we do to get the first customer, the first 100 customers, the first 1,000? And there are times where we definitely take a step back and say, okay, like, do we need to reexamine the path? You know, are we stuck at a local maximum or is there some other way to get to a better long-term outcome? Starting with the end state is not a bad way to think about the path required to get there, but it is definitely not where you stop. And so if you're interested in getting to millions and millions in customers that have booked like we have, I'd say, okay, like, get that out of your mind relatively quickly and start to think about the path to getting your first 100, your first 1,000, your first 10,000.
Yeah. So let's start there. Maybe there's an investment fund manager listening today who's coaching one of their portfolio companies, or there's, you know, founder listening today who's trying to get from their first 10 to their first 100 or from their first 100 to their first 1,000. What are some thoughts you have about those benchmarks?
Yeah. to me, there's an understanding that's helpful around your business and its likely constraints. There are some businesses that can be like lightning in a bottle, just like, man, these things can blow up overnight. And there are some businesses that try as you might, it's not going to be lightning in a bottle. And, you know, I challenge people to think about businesses that were lightning in a bottle that weren't already large existing commercial markets or free to use. You know, if you're selling TVs and everyone knows that they should have one or more TVs and you have a much better TV, you know, you can probably think about market share and category development in terms of how quickly you get it very differently than if no one's heard of the concept of a TV and you're trying to introduce why this light picture box thing is worthwhile for entertainment. And for us, you know, 90% of the market opportunity were people using friends, family, and neighbors when they travel out of town. And, you know, in the U.S., Europe's a little bit more frequent, but in the U.S., people travel about 20 nights a year away from home, maybe 22, I've seen as high as 26. But that's mostly like one big trip during the summer and some weekend getaways, put aside business travelers. And so you have this dynamic where 90% of the market, you know, goes down their Rolodex of friends, family, and neighbors. And of the people that are actually open to paying for pet services, they only need to three times a year. So there was literally nothing we could do that was going to go from 0 to 100 miles per hour in a month. Now, that's very different than, let's say, Uber, where, like, if you live in a big metropolitan area, you're used to taking taxis all over the place and they suck. They're unreliable. You can't, you know, there's a long time where it was almost impossible to pay by credit card. So you had to have cash. And so you can see that entire market basically. And if you're in a city and you get around by cab, I mean, maybe you take a cab every day, multiple times a day. And so that whole thing can spring up a lot faster. So the level of aggression by which you should pursue that is just very different. So the first thing, you know, if I'm coaching someone is, okay, well, let's, like, if you assume success, like, what does success look like? How is this category going to develop? How is your category develop? Are there a bunch of people that are already conditioned to paying for this and you just have to change their mind on what company they pay? Or are you having to convince a lot of people that they should pay for something that they thought was free or that they never even thought it is something that they should pay for to begin with? And if so, how that develops is going to be very different. And so we thought for us, some amount of PR, making use of the small amount of commercial demand that existed, but a lot of word of mouth and a lot of social proof. Social proof, I'm using the term, was like evidence that something is the norm or acceptable. And for us, social proof was going to drive adoption. And so the more it could seem normal to go online and find a dog lover in your neighborhood to watch your dog, the easier it'd get for the next person to be willing to do it. But in a lot of businesses, you don't need social proof because there's already a general acceptance that, of course, you know, if you don't want to cook, you're going to be willing to pay for a meal. So there's a bunch of businesses where that dynamic exists. So number one, understand that the natural constraints or limiting factors in your business. Figure out what are the customer acquisition channels that are going to make the most amount of sense at this point in your business. And figure out how to develop expertise or go hire expertise in those areas. We had a very specific view on how our marketing mix was likely to change over time. And so we were almost entirely devoted to a relatively small number of things early on.
Yeah, what were they early and what did they transfer to?
It's so for our business, we were like, okay, social proof and a relatively limited amount of commercial demand that we couldn't afford to pay for. So for us, I was like, okay, so we're going to do some amount of PR. We're going to do a chunk of testimonials. So get our initial sitters or to kind of market on our behalf. And so we gave them like, you know, free business cards with a discounted night type thing. And then SEO. So there was some people going to Google or Bing or whatever and searching for dog boarding, kenneling, dog sitter. Not huge volumes, but there's some amount of it. We couldn't really afford to pay for it. So how would we be a strong listing on the organic side of search? And then our thought was, as we started to figure out conversion rates, as our data science investment started to do a better job matching people and determining who the most ideal care providers were, our conversion rates would go up. Customer satisfaction would go up, so we'd get more repeat usage, and we could start paying for advertising. So we went from really not doing any paid search to, you know, being almost number one across everywhere over the course of some number of years as that played up. And as our drivers of unit economics, so a fancy way of saying repeat usage, conversion rates, and price continue to improve, we were able to turn on more and more channels, some social, some streaming, make more and more stuff
work. Like, how do you think about social media marketing versus content marketing? You know, they've got overlap, but they're not necessarily the same.
Yeah, I mean, social media marketing is a pretty broad term. You know, there's influencer type marketing,
paid ads, content, all these different
versions,
right?
Yeah, there's paid content. There is literally just paid ads that run in social media streams, sponsored posts. I'd say we thought that social in general is going to be something that's going to be big for us, but we thought a chunk of that was going to be organic because we saw that people would often go to their social media apps and ask their friends, hey, I'm leaving town. Does anyone have a good dog sitter? Will you be willing to sit my dog? And we thought that as we got bigger, more and more people would respond, you should check out Rover. And that did happen naturally and organically. Pets, you know, is one of these interesting topics. Like, you know, where you actually have more license to talk about your pet generally than a lot of other things. Like, you know, if your child is the honor student, there's only so much you can post about that before your friends are like, got it, you're a great parent, I'm tired of hearing about it. Like, but like, you know, pets are one of those things that you almost have a limited license to kind of share fun, cute things about your pets without people getting annoyed. And so we thought that social would be a good mechanism for that, which is why early on we incorporated photos into the Rover app so that people could share their experiences. We were hesitant around influencer marketing, particularly the big ones. You know, I think there are some people at the time when we were in the first couple of years that were giving huge chunks of equity to celebrities to be pretend customers of their products. And the challenge is, you know, like, I'm not sure any of that would have ever been credible to our customer base. Yes, I'm sure Oprah Winfrey pays $25 a night and goes and drops off her dog at, you know, the neighbor, you know, 10 houses down. Like, you know, we're not sure that that type of thing would have ever seemed super credible, and you'd probably get a decent amount of shares and likes on it, but probably wouldn't change much underlying behavior. Now, there are other type of influencer that's like not necessarily the megastars that can happen naturally, and it's something that, you know, maybe worth continuing to explore. But we really believe that our market is a mass market, meaning that we want to try and address 90, 99% of pet parents over time, and that the best mechanism to do that is to have people that seem relatable and very much like themselves share their experiences.
Yeah. What's another billion-dollar success secret?
Well, I know, like, the whole idea of a billion-dollar success thing is makes me think that one of my personal sayings is, you know, yesterday's victory is tomorrow's blind spot. And it is very easy because of how much work people put into their jobs, their professions, their businesses, their relationships, that like, that you have this notion or this sense that like, if you just get to this spot, like you will have made it. And, you know, I think my view is like, you know, like there really isn't a destination. And what you were super proud about yesterday, yeah, has a very real chance of being a blind spot if you don't recognize that even yesterday's wins doesn't mean that you were perfect or that you have everything figured out. And so that willingness to be wrong and to constantly be questioning what could be better is important to me and has always been. Throughout Rover's history, we've always said, hey, like there is nothing we've done that's right or correct. That's not to say we haven't done a lot of good things, but the idea that there is something that's objectively cannot be improved upon in any way, we should just never have that mentality. So the sense that, hey, success is not a destination, or your best opportunity is if it's not, is, something I think people can lose, a lot of sight of. You know, third one that's, you know, really important to me personally is, you know, how do you define, your North Star? Like, you know, how do you define what really is the ideals or the outcomes you're shooting for? And I think a lot of people can get caught up in looking at competitors as their North Star or other people doing similar things. And ultimately, your customers are your North Star. And, you know, competitors you can learn from in some cases, but most of the time they're also trying to figure things out too. And so charting your own path and not chasing your competitor's bumper is an important thing, I think, for entrepreneurs and leaders to think about. That's not to say you shouldn't be open to the path you think you're charting could be wrong. You should be. Like, it could be wrong. You may need to reexamine the path you're on. But, like, you will never do something truly unique if at some point your path doesn't diverge from others.
Yeah, can we talk about that? I'm thinking about guests we've had on the show, you know, Richard Koch wrote the 80-20 principle, right? I think he sold LEK Consulting for like $5 million. And, you know, investing in essentially category kings, you know, you pick a market, star principle, like they're growing 10% plus per year. Like whoever is the category king, that's who he invested in, right? And I turned $5 million into like, I think the last thing I saw online was like $1.4 billion personally, right? Or, the guys who wrote Play Bigger, like Chris Lockhead and the Category Pirate guys, you know, they make very compelling arguments for kind of the Warren Buffett principle of like how Warren Buffett wants to own a monopoly. Like he wants as close to a monopoly as possible with big moat and high walls and a knight with integrity defending the castle, you know, and like this idea of like, you look at the economics, this is from the Play Bigger guys and Chris Lockhead of, I think they did a Harvard Business Review study, you know, that has to go through all their vetting, that like very often the category king will capture, I want to say 76% of the equity value of the category as reflected in share price. Like it, you know, Navy SEALs say it pays to be a winner, right? Like apparently it pays to be a winner. So as you think about this idea of like both inventing and cementing your place at the top of this category, and maybe you don't frame it that way, but if you do frame it that way, what are your thoughts about it?
Yeah, well, I think it's definitely the case that with a lot of technology businesses, and people often point to online marketplaces as the quintessential example of this, you do have a lot of the economic value created by the category leader. I think That's the nature of a lot of tech businesses in the way that just wasn't true prior to tech becoming a bigger portion of the economy. You know, some of that can be driven by economies of scale. Some of that's driven by network effects. And certainly to have a large addressable market with strong network effects and large economies of scale can be really nice at kind of getting disproportionate share. You know, I think going back to the first thing you said is kind of like have a view on how your business should operate, like what would success look like and how will it be built? You know, because Rover kind of, I don't want to say disproved, but there were several kind of truisms that people would spout about marketplaces that Rover kind of said, yeah, it's more complicated than that. And so, you know, when we were getting going, there was this view that all marketplace businesses are winner takes all. And that the network effects and the economies of scales of online marketplaces are so strong that whoever jumps out to an early lead, those network effects, economies of scales were shot to snowball, and there's no way to ever compete with them. That was kind of the orthodoxy a little bit. You know, and there was a number of years where we were like in a lot of key markets, like 1/5 the size of a competitor. And yet we end up pulling ahead and blowing them away and like we're blowing past them. And it turned out it's a little bit more complicated than that. You know, and in our business, it turns out that a lot of the network effects or a lot of the economies of scales, you actually had to go earn. They didn't just happen. You had to do something to actually get them. There are a lot of businesses where the network effects and the economies of scale just happen naturally. You know, if you have a large established sales channel with lots of corporate customers and you're selling enterprise software and you have a new type of software that type of customer is going to be interested in, it can be pretty easy to add that to the sales portfolio and to scale that business in a way that a newer competitor might find challenging. You know, if you're Uber, you know, a chunk of the network effects just happen naturally. You know, if you have more drivers and more passengers in your network, you know, the average wait time is just going to be less, you know, and so the driver is going to be monetizing a larger share of their minutes, and the passenger is not going to be waiting as long. And that some of that happens naturally. In our business, though, we found out that a lot of the economies of scale actually came from the back end. So many people were in love with the idea of wanting to use not like a professional pet sitter, but like the animal lover that's in their neighborhood, like so that would treat their dog how they would want their dog to be treated, not how the expert said it should be treated. Like, so if the dog slept in the bed, they want to find somewhere the dog could sleep in the bed. If the dog went to the dog park daily, they want to find someone that would take their dog to the dog park daily. And what that meant is that the type of sitter that people were most attracted to are also the ones that were not existing full-time professionals. And there was basically no history attached to them that you could get publicly in terms of how they are as pet sitters. Are they responsive? Are their calendars accurate? Does your dog have a great time? Do you want to use them again? And so we actually said that, hey, a lot of the network effects are going to come from how we make use of those data signals, not just from the number of sitters we have on the network. And a lot of people didn't pick up on that. And so you know, we did get to a really good share position, but we didn't start there. In our European business, where we entered, there's a lot of companies that after they saw that Rover was in the U.S., decided to launch the Rover version in their country. We got to years later, and we're taking massive amounts of market share And so it's definitely the case that a lot of tech businesses have great economics for the winner or the category leader. But it's not always as simple as just become the early category leader and that snowballs.
Yeah. What do you attribute your ability to show up not at the front of the pack and get to the front of the pack? Like, give us an example, another example of like a data indicator that you guys figured out how to double down on.
Yeah. With this insight that a lot of people were going to be doing this as a full-time for professional or even part-time maybe for the first time, you know, we're like, okay, well, like, how do you try and predict how good someone's going to be before they even go live? So like what questions we asked people when they were submitting their application turned out were predictive how good they were going to be. You know, if you're like, hey, let's just go create a profile that looks a little bit like Airbnb, you know, you missed that insight. Found out that the variation among the performance of different providers was pretty high.
What's an example question?
Excuse me?
What's an example question that was a predictor?
Where can the dog sleep? Or where will the dog sleep? And, you know, someone who, the question is, you know, kind of more like, hey, like, I'm here to make sure your dog has a great time. Where would your dog like to sleep? And that was more the vibe of their answer would be a better sitter than here is the place where the dog sleeps. Similarly, when we asked for people about their experience with animals and their experience with pets, you know, the people who had answers more along the lines of I am a dog whisperer actually performed less well. There's this implicit thing of like, I know what's right for your animal. That's kind of implied in that. And for people, it's like, well, like, I'm the one who, like, has designed my animal's life and interactions with me. Like, I want someone that's going to basically do what I do when I'm God. So subtle things like that. We also perhaps were a little bit surprised, but there was a period of time where, like, professional certifications was a negative indicator. Because again, people were really like, no, I want to find another version of me that's going to treat my dog how I would or my cat how I would. There's a lot of businesses where the service providers or the things being sold in a marketplace are not that differentiated. You know, I think as an example that if you're thinking about DoorDash, you know, most people don't really care who delivers their food as long as it comes relatively quick and it's not like turned upside down, you know, in the meantime. And most of the delivery drivers within a range are pretty similar, you know, but we saw that there was wild differentiation. So much more of our business was going to be built on spotting that differentiation early. We found that people who sent regular updates or would send photos were much more likely to get repeat business, and the perception of how they were as a sitter was just different. So like all of a sudden, like taking into account the photo sending rate was something that mattered a lot. So those are some of the things that were a little bit different. But in general, I think it is pretty much a truism that you do need to chart your own course because, so much of the economics can go to the top one or two players. And I would argue that even if there's a category with two or three players that seem relatively successful, you know, more often than not, it's not that they're number two objectively. It's that they may be number two overall, but they're probably number one for some segment or some portion of that market. With tech, you know, it is, there's not a lot of value to be the distant number four.
Yeah. Those are it's fun to hear the specifics, because then the rest of us can think, well, what's the version of that in my industry? Aaron, this has been super fun. Besides going to the website or getting the Rover app on their phones, what do you want to leave people with today?
I'd say, you know, if you don't have a dog, and the concerns around the logistics have you scared to get a dog, you know, I'd encourage you to rethink those. Rover has made it possible for people to live busy, single lives and still have a dog in their life, still have a cat in their life. We know that even, you know, households with more than one people, a lot of times there are multiple people working. You can go out on vacation, live a happy life, and have an animal. And if you've never had a dog or a cat in your life, you know, just consider whether or not you're missing out.
I like it. Well, thanks again for making time for this.
Well, Jess, thank you so much. I appreciate you having me on.
You bet. Bye, everyone.